This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. This is episode 136 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, how are we?
Good, David. How are you?
I'm good. And guess what? We have a guest tonight. And guess what? They're in Philadelphia.
Are they right with you?
No, they're not with me, but I'm hoping that we'll be able to spend some face-to-face time tomorrow. So why don't we introduce our guest?
Absolutely. Our guest this episode is Fred Sampson. Now, Fred works for a large international software company during the day, but he's also a 400-hour FAA certified pilot. He's a formation lead, aerobatic pilot, and drone enthusiast. In fact, he's a member of the San Francisco chapter of the International Drone Racing Association. He races on the national circuit, and he helps people get into the sport. Now, you might have heard Fred on the Airline Pilot Guy podcast, maybe on the In the Pattern podcast. And if that's not enough notoriety, Fred was also one of the pilots in that Star Wars video. So, Fred, welcome to the UAV Digest.
Hi, guys. It's absolutely awesome to be here tonight.
Now, we're happy to be talking to you about FPV racing. We've talked about that a little bit in the past, but this time we've got a racer with us. And, Fred, we're really interested in learning more about the fun racing that you do.
Excellent.
So I guess let's start off with, we're using jargon, and maybe there are people who aren't sure what FPV is. You want to give the definition there, Fred?
Yeah, FPV is first-person view, and racing is exactly what you would think. It's racing, and so we take drones, usually pretty small drones. Just to give you guys an example, my racer weighs just about the same as the battery in the new DJI Phantom 4. So we make them as lightweight as we can, and then we have a video system that we install on these that let us fly the drone from the perspective of the drone itself. So there's a camera and a video transmitter, and then we sit, and we look really silly doing this, but we sit in lawn chairs, and we have goggles on, and we pilot the drone as if we were sitting in it. And it's it allows us to fly very differently than if we were flying line of sight. In other words, you know, we can go behind obstacles, underneath things, over things, and it's a very, very different style of flying.
Fred, this kind of racing seems to have really exploded in popularity in the last year, and not just in the United States, but really all around the world. Is this something that you expected to see? Why is this growing so quickly?
It's growing, Max, from a perspective of pilots. You know, it's not even a spectator sport just yet. So I did some math just before the podcast. We estimate that at the end of 2000, and these are very rough numbers, mostly based on social media and video views and that kind of stuff. But we estimate that at the end of 2014, there were roughly 10,000 people in the world that were seriously involved in this. This year, about this time, we're about 50,000. And in terms of legitimacy, next week in Dubai is the first world competition for drone racing. So in about a year and a half, we've gone from local guys racing in local parks with made up gear that they made themselves to a full industry now that is around the world online, and then has a full backing of manufacturers that make custom equipment for this. So but in about a year and a half, we've grown fivefold.
Fred, let me ask you this. For our listeners who have a DJI Phantom and aren't necessarily pilots, you are a certified flight instructor and aerobatic pilot and stuff. what's the transition like from flying first person, from flying a DJI, say a DJI Phantom to a first person view? Is it, is there a lot of skill? Is it, I mean, I can imagine spatial orientation from my RC days, you know, the, it was always to remember if you invert the aircraft, your controls are going to be in the opposite direction that your normal level flight. But what kind of transition did you have, or did you go straight to FPV?
I actually, I'm a little bit embarrassed to say, I went straight to FPV. So my, we call them LOS or line of sight skills, which is what you use when you fly a Phantom or if you fly without the FPV system, are okay, you know, if there's a system failure, I can deal with that and bring the craft back. But, you know, I've watched some guys fly LOS and it's just purely magic. They are two completely different activities. The learning curve, flying FPV is essentially easier. And there's probably a couple of people now screaming at their iPods that have been trying to learn this for 6 months. But the learning curve is a little bit higher. And so it's one of these things that as soon as you master it, you can progress very quickly after that. But there is a little bit of a learning curve. It's well known that that full-scale pilots, which is what they call us in the RC community, just don't make good RC pilots. So a lot of the skills just don't
see, folks. I've said that for years, but no one believes me.
David, there's a small exception to that, which is that aerobatic pilots make fantastic RC pilots, and that's because we use a different set of references. You know, for example, we don't use up and down. We use a different set of resource references for what the controls in an airplane do. I'll agree with you. You know, not a lot of skills transfer over. I think if you've played a lot of video games, you probably have a better advantage than somebody that's a full-scale pilot for this. There's a lot of adults that are involved in this now. I think we should get our glory while we can, because as soon as the next generation of 14 to 16-year-olds that are out there now start doing this, we're done.
Well, without getting into stereotypes, is there a certain type of person that seems to be attracted to FPV racing?
Yeah, there really isn't, and that's what I like about this community. I mean, this is a brand new, it's a digital sport, right? This wouldn't exist without the internet, without YouTube, without Instagram. You just couldn't build one of these, go out and learn to fly, and then meet people to do this with without the modern infrastructure behind this. And so the community is incredibly diverse. Just in our own team, we have guys of various ages. We've got guys that are more technically oriented, you know, guys that like to build, guys that like to program and tinker. We got guys that like to play video games. There's a lot of folks that have come over from RC. So traditional RC pilots have come over and have done this. Those guys are very present in the community, and they carry a really interesting legacy and maybe a little bit of an advantage as well. But just like when skiing splintered into snowboarding, you know, there's a whole bunch of folks that are coming into the hobby now only to fly FPV quads. And so they're bringing their own style and they're bringing their own attitude, even, you know, and fashion, to be honest with you, to the sport as well. So it's absolutely incredibly diverse. We have guys that would be just as home in a lab at Stanford, and we've got folks that would be, you know, just as home in the at the skate park. So it's a really cool community.
I'm curious to know, across the different organizations that sponsor races, even within the racing leagues and so forth, are there different categories? How common are the categories across these things? Is it just a sort of a hodgepodge of different rules and that sort of thing? Or is there some uniformity, well, either across the United States or globally?
That's a hot debate if you go into some of our online communities. My take on this is that we're still figuring this out, that there's still a lot of room for innovation, that there's still a lot of room for skill. At no point have I been to an event where I thought that somebody won because they had better equipment or a different kind of a setup. This is still very difficult. You're a little bit like motorcycle racing. You know, it's exciting because you get rewarded if you take chances, but you can also fail if you take too many chances. And so it makes for very exciting racing, but it doesn't give you an advantage. There are organizations out there that are trying to standardize around certain formats. There's an organization called DRL out of New York, and they do a lot of really high quality broadcast stuff. And so they've optimized their craft and their racing for broadcast. In Dubai next week, they're trying something different, which is really cool. They're trying to do live HD video feeds from each of the craft. So to carry that equipment, craft have to be a bit bigger, have to run bigger batteries, bigger propellers, and they're running on a bigger course. So I think we're going to see some specialization. I think also as new people come in, we're going to need space for people to compete at different skill levels. We fly every day. I'm on a business trip and I've brought my equipment with me. And if I can sneak out a half an hour and find a park, I'll go fly a few batteries. And that's what it takes to keep up at the level that we want to be racing at. And I say we want to be because we don't always do well. You know, for some folks that race once a week or once a month, or quite frankly, don't want that level of competitiveness. I ultimately see this becoming multiple series and multiple different classes. But I think we're all still figuring this out as the sport grows. I think we'll see that. By the way, are the listeners familiar with what I mean when I say racing, in the sense of the track and the, I know you guys have seen the videos.
Yeah, sure. And I've attended one race anyway. But yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. Talk about are we typically racing against the clock, racing against other competitors? What's the course like? Maybe you can describe those things a little bit.
Absolutely. So, Max, you probably saw a race that was in a park or an athletic field, probably. Yes. Had some gates that you go under or over, tunnels maybe, and flags like at your car dealership that you spin around and fly the course that way. And that's probably the most common right now.
Yes.
As we're doing more and more of this, we're getting more creative. We're getting more creative for two reasons. One is that we can design tracks now to take out specific advantages. You know, so if you have, for example, a track with very long straights, that might give an advantage to somebody with a certain type of machine as opposed to somebody else. And so we're designing around that, but we're also trying to make the courses very interesting. So we're incorporating natural features, you know, go around the tree. We're incorporating things like, if you've seen some of our videos, we fly in and out of buildings as well. So we've got a portion inside, portion that's outside. And there's some events that are completely inside, but they're both fundamentally the same in the sense that there are obstacles. We usually race like any other form of race against our competitors for the best time. The races are usually quite short, you know, 3 to 4 laps. That's just because the batteries don't last that long. Also your concentration, you know, being that focused for, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 minutes is a really a different class of I think mental ability. But the races tend to be short, but there tend to be multiple heats. So multiple qualifications, multiple semifinals, quarterfinals, and finals. And then we, at some events, not all of them, but that's becoming more standard now, we use a electronic lap timing system. And so we actually have, for example, for qualifying, actual lap times. We want to make sure that the faster pilots get a chance to move forward. It's heartbreaking when you crash because normally you either break a propeller or you're upside down and you can't take off again. But and that's why there are also multiple rounds, because a lot of times there's quite a lot of crashes. It could also be a mid-air collision. Different scales, some small tracks, like it could be inside of a large high school gymnasium, and we've seen that, to tracks outside that are sometimes a kilometer long. We're often limited by there's two things that are limiting us right now. One is the battery capacity, because as we add more battery capacity, we add weight, and then we decrease flight time and decrease performance. But also our video link. We use available consumer frequencies. So we use the same frequencies as your Wi-Fi router at home, for example, runs on. And so we're limited by the amount of power that we can broadcast and therefore the range. So the race courses tend to be quite small for that reason.
Yeah, you mentioned at Dubai that they were looking to broadcast an HD video. I think that's been kind of one of the big issues in terms of kind of converting this into a greater spectator sport. And we've seen some ideas concerning, you know, a delayed broadcast where the pilots are flying on a low-res, you know, video feed, whereas maybe there's a separate feed that is used for an HD playback later. Where is that going? It seems like this whole issue of quality of the video feed is what's going to drive audience viewing of races.
Yeah, and Max, there's so many good points in there. I think one is that we don't know where the audience is going to come from. And I think there are different ideas and we're trying different things. Whether it comes from a live audience, which is, by the way, really fun. If you get to, I've put some listings in the show notes if you guys want to attend one of the local events. It's actually just really fun to watch. But we don't. We think most of us think that the audience is going to come from being a native online sport, going to natively come online. So that capability will dramatically increase what we do. But the setup you described is exactly spot on. On my racer, for example, I have a very low quality, but very low latency, so that we can fly very, so that there's no delay in the video link.
Yeah.
You know, we used to say that if you see a tree, you've already hit it if you have any latency in your system.
Yeah.
And then the video that you see on the on YouTube or some of the other feeds come from a basically a GoPro or a similar camera that's mounted on. So there's two cameras, and we edit that after the race. I think the DRL is editing after the race. It'll be interesting to do that. And the other limiting factor for us is that analog video frequency band is quite congested. And so we can only run about 8 pilots. It's about the maximum we can run for an event. Now there's some maybe it's 6, maybe it's 9, but it's never a high number of pilots, which limits our ability to do bigger races. And I think the holy grail of this will be when somebody cracks the move from our current zero latency analog systems to a very low or zero latency digital system. And then you'll be able to get better quality video, be able to broadcast it. And that's probably the next frontier for us to grow the audience.
You as a racer are building this with the knowledge that you're probably going to crash it eventually, right? One of those things that was in model aircraft, or when we were used to doing, I'm really going to date myself, control line battles, it was you built it. You know, the control line battle aircraft were built to be destroyed. And in this case, how do you find the balance between something that you know is might hit a wall and building it so that it can kick everybody else's butt?
It's agonizing, David. The first one you build is always pristine, and you take your time and you make it perfect, and you use similar color wire, and then you only do that once. Because you're rebuilding it that night. We normally stop flying when we run out of aircraft to fly that day. It could be as simple as a broken propeller or a broken strap, or it could be something as serious as a broken frame. But no, we build more than we fly. I think as you get better and better, you crash less. But it's like any other sport, right? So you start to go faster, and you crash a little more. You get better, you crash a little bit less, so it oscillates. I think you have to find the gear that works for you. I think beginners tend to have gear that's a little bit heavier and a little bit more crash resistant. Guys are at a little higher level tend to have lighter weight gear. When you get to the point where you can feel 10 grams, I think is when 10 grams start to make a difference. But I think if you put a 25-gram weight on my quad and blindfold me and let me go fly it, I'll know that you did something to it. It really does feel different.
Fred, what about safety for the spectators as well as for those competing in the competition? Has that been an issue, and how is that being dealt with?
We're lucky. Max, the race you went to probably had a nice course that was set aside, and there was clear markings.
Yes.
When we do organized events, that's usually the case. We usually have sometimes even a fenced area, right? We'll go to a local high school and we'll get use of their athletic field, and then that's all fenced out. If we do it in a public place, we'll make sure that we're very visible. We put yellow safety tape everywhere. And the rule is quite simple. If there's people around or people on the course, we just don't fly. And I think there's a sort of unwritten rule amongst the community. It's a really delicate balance, right? David, you talked earlier about the Before You Fly app, and we're flying EOSs and most of them. I say most of them because that's not true. I think half of them are over the FAA registration limit. The other half are on purpose below the 2 sticks of butter FAA weight. But we understand that finding places to fly and to practice and to hold events is difficult. You know, unfortunately, not all of us are landowners, and we have a few acres that we can do this on. So we have to rely on public land, and we know that it's a privilege. So there's sort of a it takes a lot of people to organize a race, but it only takes one person to stop it and to never be allowed to fly there again. And so we're very cognizant of that, and we just don't fly if there's people around.
Yeah.
It's really just that simple. It's not worth it. But it is interesting to see the reaction of folks. Most folks will come and talk to us. I mean, there was even one person who brought us donuts one time because he thought that what we were doing was really cool. But most of the time, we don't have an issue. I would probably say 99.9% of the people that we've met have been really cool. Once in a while, somebody will say, hey, I want to use this park for something else. I want to walk my dog here. And, you know, we're not going to win that one. So I think part of being able to be successful in this is to have good community relations with other folks around.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point, one that I was going to kind of bring up, that staging an event is kind of a good opportunity, I would imagine, to help, you know, make other people aware of what these drones are and sort of raise the level of awareness, have some good dialogue, some good conversations with just, you know, average people who might be curious about all this drone stuff.
Absolutely. I laugh a little bit because it's funny, but other drone racers out here are also laughing because they know what I'm about to say. But we always get the same exact five questions from anybody that randomly comes up. They're always so much so that somebody made a T-shirt with the answers on them.
Oh, and those five – well, now you're going to have to share because so that anybody else know, all of our listeners know not to ask you these.
So I'll start with the answers. We'll do Jeopardy style. But the first one is yes. And that's usually the answer to the question, is this a drone? Hmm. And we've given up trying to explain to people what they are. We just call them drones. It's perfectly fine. The second question is about $200 to $300, which is how much does it cost? The third question is either how far can you go or how fast or how high? And it's usually not very far, very fast, and not very high. The other question is yes, which is a question to did you build this yourself? And the fifth question is, the internet, which is basically, hey, I want to get into this. Where do I get started? And so if you ever see a T-shirt that says, yes, $200, yes, yes, and the internet, that's exactly what we're trying to answer.
I like that. We need to make those shirts and sell them on like the cafe press store.
I'll send you a design, David. It's fantastic. But the reaction, guys, I think this is a little bit where I would love to share some of the passion around this because you should see kids when they watch us do this in a park. I mean, they come and they talk and they look at the machines and the questions. The parents are very supportive of this. I mean, there's mechanical components to this. I mean, these things are built out of beautiful carbon fiber. There is electrical the around the motors and the speed controllers. We run very, very simple flight controllers. And so I forgot to mention, we usually fly these in what we call manual or acro mode, which is basically the flight controller will maintain the attitude, but it doesn't provide any sort of self-stabilization or leveling or any of that. We do all that ourselves, and that's to get the most performance out of the machine. So the flight controllers are really simple. They run open source software, which you can go download and contribute to. And so if you're if you're somebody that's between 12 and 16 today, this is probably the best hobby ever invented. I mean, it's just so much fun. We talked a little bit earlier as well about what does it take to get into this. Well, building is one thing, which is a big deal because if your machine doesn't fly, you can't fly. And there's nothing more frustrating than getting to the field and having a vibration problem or flying for 2 minutes, having your thing fall out of the sky. You have to be able to fly. And then if you want to grow in the sport, you have to have a social media presence. You got to learn how to do video and edit with music and be online. And so it's really a multifaceted hobby. From that perspective, I think, you could also go to your backyard and do this by yourself. But once you step into the greater community, it's just so much fun. And, you couldn't do this by yourself. You have you post a question online about, hey, do these two pieces fit together? And you get an answer within about 15 seconds. So it's a wonderful community ready to help and ready to grow itself.
Fred, maybe you can give us some resources, some places where we can go online to learn more, to get more engaged or involved in this. What do you suggest?
If you want to go to an event, there's an organization, there's several of them. And there's a couple ones. One is, I think if anybody's interested in just viewing what this looks like at the world level, and by the way, I have no idea how interesting this is going to be because it's never been done before, but the worlddronepre.com is where that's going to be live broadcasted next week. And that's on the, I believe, 11th or 12th or 10th or 11th of March. There's an organization in the U.S. and maybe worldwide called MultiGP. They're at multigp.com, and that's an organization of local chapters. So if you want to find out if you're interested in watching or learning or even participating in your local area, they'll list all of the local races, and there's an incredible calendar on there. And then I think also if you just Google racing drone on YouTube, there's a series of videos, some very popular pilots out there that have over 50,000 followers. that put up great videos every week. So if you guys are wondering, if you guys are having a hard time visualizing what we're talking about, if you just Google racing drone on YouTube, you'll see a whole bunch of videos of guys racing and guys doing tricks and talking about how to build these different drones. So that's probably just the best place to start.
And how about you personally? Where can we find out more about you?
The best place to find me is on Instagram. And, you know, it's a little bit like every community has their own corner of social media. But for us, it's mostly Instagram, and it's Fred Flies, but it's with a three. So it's FR3D underscore FLY. And we usually post videos and pictures of the races and the events and everything else on there.
Very cool. Very cool. You know, when I think of racing, and I tend to follow motorsports in some degree of detail, and of course the phrase you hear all the time is racing improves the breed, and I think that, you know, that can apply to motorsports, it can apply to horse racing, it can apply to almost almost anything. Has that effect come to the drone racing yet, or is it just too early, you know, sort of in its life cycle?
No, I think it's driving a ton of technological requirements. I think battery technology in particular is somewhere where there could be a lot of improvements, especially around weight and capacity. We don't need large batteries, but we need batteries that can discharge very, very quickly, acceleration, top speed, that kind of stuff. And I think also on materials, in terms of carbon fiber and new materials, 3D printing, and then we already covered video, right, as well. So we're definitely in search of better video technologies, and I think we'll get them as we get more attention on the world stage.
Very good. Well, David, what do you think?
I think I owe Fred a beer, and I think that'll happen tomorrow night. And maybe this weekend I might actually try flying FPV.
Cool. Well, you have to let us know how it works out. Tell us if you get all dizzy and disoriented.
Yeah, it's, gee, thanks.
Check my Instagram feed. Maybe we'll broadcast that.
Yeah, there we go.
But Fred, thank you so much. And you'll keep in touch with us and maybe keep us in the loop on what's going on and when you start racking up the trophies from all of these races.
I'll come back in the year and I'll report if I've been doing better or if the sport is growing around me and I'm still at the same level. We got invited to go to Dubai. Fortunately, it was a bit last minute for a team of five people to get the logistics together, so we didn't get to go, but we're looking forward to much, much more events, and we're looking forward to being surprised as to what happens with this.
So, oh, and this week's video of the week will be Fred racing one of his quads through a warehouse. So we'll check out the show notes for that.
Excellent.
And Max, do you want to mention how to become a slacker for the UAV Digest?
Okay, sure. Yes. Yes. Well, we have a listener team that we've built. It uses this Slack platform, which you can think of as kind of a persistent chat room on steroids. It has a lot of other features. And we've primarily been using this over at the Airplane Geeks podcast. So we'd like to invite all of you listening to the UAV Digest to come and take a look as well. You can learn more about this by visiting airplanegeeks.com/team. It'll tell you a little bit about what it is and how to get an invite to it. So we have a channel in there specifically for the UAV Digest, and that's an area where some of you might want to come participate, join in the conversation. It's an alternative to other social media places where you might hang out, but the nice thing about this is it tends to be very focused, and it's not open to the general public, as it were. So it's a little bit more of a closed community that stays a little bit more focused than you'd find otherwise. So,
in other words, it's an exclusive club, so you want to definitely join.
Yeah, we'd love to have you over there. So take a look at airplanegeeks.com/team for more about it and how to get an invite.
And we'll put links in the show notes, of course.
Absolutely.
So I think we've got news, but I think we'll skip that because
I think we'll hold it over. Yep.
Because Fred was more entertaining than FAA news, and thank God for that.
We want to thank you for listening to episode 136 of the UAV Digest. You can find us at theuavdigest.com, which will tell you how to contact us and how to find us on Twitter and Facebook. You can support the show by becoming a patron, and you can find out more about that on our website as well. Show notes for this episode are at theuavdigest.com/136.
So I guess with that, I'll say this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thank you so much for listening.